A listener supported community radio for the Sacramento LA to put us in the on. LA Sound signing off. Stay tuned for Alternative Radio.
Alternative Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Baker's Birkenstock, featuring more than 40 brands of footwear, purses, hats, and more. Baker's Birkenstock has been serving our community for over 40 years with locations at 333 Broadway Street in downtown Chico and at 691 Fir Street in Paradise, also on Facebook, and by California Jobs First, seeking interested parties to help shape the future of the North State region. Whether you're a concerned citizen, business owner, or community leader, the organizers of the North State Region's California Jobs First Initiative would love to hear from you. To learn more about the process and efforts underway in the North State, visit nspdc.csuchico.edu. Thank you very much to Baker's Birkenstock and California Jobs First for your support of Alternative Radio on KZFR.
Thank you, baby. All right, so you have a good week out there. Stay tuned for Alternative Radio.
The number of people who are in power who are psychopaths is somewhere between 4 times and 25 times the general public. This is not good, right? This is a very, very bad thing for us, because even though they may be ruthlessly calculating individuals who sometimes can be logical thinkers, in those moments of crisis, when things are really on the line and change is happening rapidly, that's when empathy is most important. It's when you have to care about other people, and they don't have it.
That's Brian Kloss, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Brian Kloss on the wrong people at the top. Power, what is it? Political theorist Robert Dahl gave one example. He said, A has power over B to the extent that he can get B to do something that he would not otherwise do. Why is it that often that those who are on top are the wrong people? The high rollers and the nabobs lust for power behind a smokescreen of homilies about doing good. Today, we see more and more power concentrated in the hands of the few, thus weakening democracy. Who wields power, and how is it allocated? What are effective ways to make sure that power is not abused and serves the societal greater good? How can we get the right people on top? To talk about these issues is Brian Kloss. Political science Brian Kloss researches power and corruption. He's professor of global politics at the University College London and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. He's the author of Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. He spoke in Copenhagen, Denmark in 2023. And now, Brian Kloss.
I'd like to start with this. Why don't you raise your hand if you think that systems of power around the world are mostly getting it right? Okay, so I haven't seen any hands out of about 1,000 people. How about this one? Raise your hand if you could, in an instant, switch places with a politician such that they would take your job and you would have to have their career for the rest of your life. I see a few hands, but not many. These are two problems, right? We have two serious problems that nobody who is a normal, decent person wants to become a politician or wants to become a leader. And secondly, that we basically are all fed up with the people who are in charge of us. Now, the problems around power have been plaguing humans for thousands of years. We've made huge technological innovations in almost every area of modern society, except for this one. We are dealing with the exact same questions today that ancient Greeks and ancient Romans were dealing with. And I think we can do better than that. I think we can design better systems, and I think we can get better people in power so that everybody's hand goes up when I ask you who wants to be a politician. And I think we can design better systems so we think everyone wants to say, yes, we've got it right. So what I did in my work is I went around the world and I met with people who are powerful. I conducted about 500 interviews with former heads of state, despots, people who ordered torture, war criminals, rebels, people who plotted coups, and generals, along with CEOs and leaders in Western societies. And what I found that was really interesting is that when you think about this group of people, they are not normal. And I don't mean that necessarily as an insult. I mean that they're not average. They're not representative of the population. There's something about them. And we need to understand that. Now, if you were to imagine meeting a zoologist who studied elephants, and you said, you know, so how often do you interact with elephants? And they said, never. I've never seen one. I've never actually observed one. You'd find that very weird. And yet, a lot of social science doesn't involve actually going and observing and talking to these real breathing people who can answer our questions. And so I think we need to actually scrutinize, understand, and get better at figuring out what makes these people tick so that we can ensure that nobody likes them ends up in power again. Now, the reason that nobody raised their hand in the first question, systems of power being about right, isn't hard to understand. We are surrounded by dangerous people in positions of immense responsibility. And this is not just in foreign, faraway authoritarian countries like in Russia or China. It's also where I'm from in the United States. And you'll also sympathize with me because I am an American, and yet I live in the UK. So I've had to deal back and forth with thinking about which country is more messed up in terms of its democracy, right? Looking back home to the United States and then living in a place where the prime minister failed to outlast a lettuce and only survived in power for 45 days. So we have our work cut out for us. We have serious problems in our modern societies, and the question tonight is how can we do better? How can we ensure that everyone thinks that the systems of power are working for them? Now, I will say that a lot of the places that I work are much more dystopian than Denmark. Denmark is one of these places where you often bring it up as an example of a virtuous and well-run society. And I think it deserves that reputation globally to a very large extent. But even here, when I talk to people, they say, we don't have the best among us. We have many of the worst among us in positions of power. How can we get this fixed? How can we make it better? So the question that my book asks is four questions, in fact. And those questions are as follows. Do worse people get power? Does power make people worse? Why do we let people control us who clearly have no business being in control? Why do we allow this? And finally, how can we ensure that incorruptible people end up in charge instead or get power instead? Now, to begin with this, every time I've met someone who has understood what I study, basically bad people who do bad things in power, they have trotted out some version of this quote, the most famous quote about power. Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's a quote from Lord Acton. It's true. But there's a much more complicated, much more interesting story that actually is more solvable that I'm going to talk about tonight. Part of this story will be about power corrupting, power making people worse, which it does. But we'll also talk about all these hidden factors that are often ignored, to our own peril and detriment, because the systems around positions of power are extremely important. And they're not just important because they affect outcomes, they're important because they're the things that you can fix most easily. It's hard to change the magnetism of power, it's hard to change the way that power changes people's psychology and their neurology. What is easier to change is the systems we design that determine who ends up in the top. So the first question, let's start with the easier one. Does power corrupt? The answer is yes. But let's look at a few detailed examples of this. And the poster child for the idea that power corrupts was one of the interviews, one of the weirdest interviews that I've done, met this woman a few times. And her name is Ma Anand Sheela. If you've seen the Netflix documentary Wild Wild Country, you probably recognize this person. What she did was she was a sort of an art student in India, growing up age 18 and looking for a bigger meaning in life, something beyond sort of you know, the dystopia of modern society and so on. So she joined a New Age guru named Bhagwan Sri Ragnish, and she decided to work for what would develop into a sort of cult. And as the group was pushed out of India, she was tasked with building an international city in rural Oregon, where she bought a massive ranch called Big Muddy Ranch, and she turned it into the Rajneesh's home in the United States. So thousands of people descend on this small area in rural Oregon. And she develops immense power. And it's not just worldly power either, because at some point, the guru takes a vow of silence. And so she becomes the voice of the guru. This is a kind of power that most of us will never experience. And it warps her. It warps her so much that she decides to try to take over the local town because they're not playing ball with what she wants to do. So she runs a series of American candidates who are members of this sort of New Age cult. And they take over Rajneesh, they take over the area called Antelope, Oregon, and they rename it Rajneesh Puram. Now, Rajneesh Puram is basically run by this group, but the county starts to make noises about saying, we're not going to approve your permits, we're going to shut you down. Now, there aren't enough people in the American side of the sort of New Age cult to take over the county, so she needs to come up with a plan B. And her plan B was this: to rig the local election by depressing turnout. And the way she was going to depress turnout was by poisoning 1,000 people, which is what she did. So she is the worst bioterrorist in American history. She did a test run for the election, and she sprinkled, along with her henchmen, salmonella on a series of salad bars around rural Oregon, and 1,000 people were poisoned. Now, what's amazing about this story is you have this sort of trajectory, starting as an 18-year-old art student, hasn't done anything wrong in her life at that point. But the question is, maybe she was just rotten all along, right? Maybe it wasn't the power that corrupted her. So she served time in prison as the worst bioterrorist in American history. She moved to Switzerland after she was deported. And the Swiss government, which, you know, is a reasonable stickler for the rules, found the application without fail, and they decided to give her a care home to run, which she does with vulnerable people. And as far as I can tell, nothing since then has gone wrong. She hasn't done anything illegal. This is the sort of classic case of power corrupting. A good person tastes power and is just warped beyond belief. Trying to poison people, she tried to assassinate various officials and so on. It was absolutely crazy. Now, the second story that I'll tell you is one that some of you will be familiar with. If you have read an intro psychology textbook or listened to a popular psychology podcast, you will probably have heard of the Stanford Prison Experiment. If you haven't heard of it, here's the basics of the prison experiment, and I'm going to invert it in a second, because I think everything you know about it, if you do know about it, is actually wrong. So the gist of the Stanford Prison Experiment is this. A man named Philip Zimbardo converted the basement of the Stanford Psychology Department into a fake jail. And then he recruited people for a psychological study of prison life to randomly be assigned whether to be a student who would be a prison guard or a prisoner. And so the question was, what happens when they put on the uniform and they become powerful in this fake experiment? Well, what happened was extremely scary, because within a couple days, the prisoners, who were just students at Stanford, had started abusing and humiliating their prisoners. They had been physically attacking them, so much so that Zimbardo's girlfriend at the time shut the experiment down. She said, you have to stop this. It's unethical. You can't continue. And so the evidence that this produced was the idea that if you just put the right person into a prison uniform as a prison guard, they'll become corrupt. They'll abuse the people. It's not the person, it's the uniform, right? Power corrupts. There's a problem with this narrative, though, and it's one that hasn't been noticed very much in the world of psychology or in social research. And that's that about a decade ago, some researchers in Kentucky at a university that gets a lot less attention than Stanford, they noticed something peculiar about the way that recruitment was done for this study. And what they found was that the ad said for a psychological study of prison life. What they decided to do was to replicate the exact wording of the ad, except for in half of the university towns, they would say for a psychological study. And in half of the university towns, they would say for a psychological study of prison life. And then they saw who showed up. And they did psychometric tests and evaluations of personality types and so on all the people who responded. And what they found was that the people who responded to the psychological study of prison life wording were systematically more authoritarian, abusive, Machiavellian, and narcissistic and psychopathic than the people who responded to the generic study. And so this completely inverts the finding of the Stanford prison experiment, right? It's not that people put on the uniform and became corrupt or abusive. It's that people who wanted the uniform were more likely to be corrupt and abusive in the first place. And this inverts the finding. It's not that power corrupts, it's that power attracts the corruptible. This is a much bigger effect. It's a much more important area, is that we have this problem of power acting like a magnet to people who should not be in power. Now, to understand how this works, I'm going to divert your attention away from prisons and politicians for a second to World War II. There's a man named Abraham Wald who was a statistician who fled from Nazi Germany, and he ended up working at Columbia in New York, Columbia University. He was enlisted to help with the Allied war effort, and they asked him a very simple question. They said, look, we have a series of warplanes that have come back from Germany in their bombing runs, and they have bullet holes in various places throughout the plane. We want you to tell us where we should reinforce. And so some of the generals said we must reinforce the wings. Some said we should do it in the tail, reinforce the tail. Some said in the middle, where there's the concentration of bullet holes. Abraham Wald looked at these airplanes in this hangar and said, if you take any of those three paths, you're going to kill a lot of pilots. And the reason you're going to kill a lot of pilots is because you need to worry about the invisible planes. And what he meant by that is that all the planes that you could see had made it back from Germany. They'd survived. They had been able to fly home. The ones that you couldn't see, the ones that were shot in the engines, were in Germany. They were invisible. And this has given rise to a concept called survivorship bias. It's sometimes also called the caveman effect, because it may be the case that cavemen didn't really paint in caves that often or live in caves, but just that what survived is the stuff that was outside of the elements. If a caveman painted on a tree, it was long gone by the time we were looking at it. So the idea of survivorship bias is that you have to think about what survives. Now, this matters a lot for power, because power, when we see the people who are powerful, the CEOs, the politicians, etc., they've survived three different levels of power. They have sought power, so you have to seek power in the first place. They've obtained power, and they've managed to stay in power. Now, the third point may seem less important, but many of you have probably not heard of a man named Pedro Lascarán, and the reason you have not heard of him is because he was the president of Mexico for 45 minutes. Now, this issue is one where there's a certain kind of person who is really obsessed with getting power, there's a certain kind of person who is very good at getting power, and there's also a certain kind of person that is good at staying in power. If you have all three of those, you're more likely to become powerful. And what we're selecting for are not necessarily correlated with what's good for governing or good for leading a business. It's what's good for maintaining power or seeking it in the first place. Many of you don't really care about not being a CEO or being a politician. In fact, when I asked you to raise your hand, most of you would not trade places with a politician because of the way the political system works. So this is called self-selection bias. Self-selection bias is tied to power, where it's the idea that we wait for people to say, I should be powerful, right? We wait for people to sort of just walk out and say, I'm the one who should be in charge. That's self-selection bias. It's rolling out the red carpet to people who are power hungry. Now, when we say power hungry, we mean bad, right? I mean, power hungry has never been said as a praise, an adjective of praise. But what it literally means is someone who wants power. It is not a very mysterious thing that people who want power are more likely to end up there than the rest of us. So these are the invisible planes that I'm talking about. The large group of people that are in your lives who would be great leaders, but never end up in power. Partly because they didn't want it, partly because they weren't good at getting it, or they lost it when they did obtain it. And this is the paradox that we find ourselves in. I mean, when I think about my own life, I'm sure when you think about your lives, the people around you are good and decent. You find them to be people who are ethical, concerned with others, care about public service very often. And then you look up in society and you say, wait a minute, why is it different, right? Self-selection bias is one of the key answers. However, this is always going to be a universal aspect of power, right? We're always going to have self-selection bias. So what do we do about it? Well, this is where systems are really, really important. And the way you design a system and tweak it and adjust it can determine who ends up on top. Now, I'm going to tell you a story now that makes Denmark look very good. So there's a study that I write about in my book, which is called the DICE study. It's a very simple idea. They take students and they give them a dice. And they say, roll it 42 times and write down your score each time. But here was the catch. Every time you roll a 6, we'll give you some money. Now, we're also not going to watch you roll the dice, and we're not going to watch you write down your scores. So you could lie. But of course, with statistical methods, it's pretty easy to tell when someone is lying systematically, right? So one participant in India, bonus points for how brazen he was, wrote down 42 sixes in a row. Good for him for trying. Now, what was fascinating about this was they then looked at who lied on the dice rolls and what their future career ambitions were. In India, where the civil service is known for having a track record of bribery and graft, where you can get rich by extorting people, the people who lied on their dice rolls were the ones who wanted to go into the civil service. Completely, a very, very strong correlation, a pathway from lying in this experiment to wanting to be a civil servant. They repeated the study elsewhere around the world, and one of the places they repeated was in Denmark. And the results were exactly flipped. What they found was that the people who lied on their dice rolls wanted to go to business, and the people who very, very honestly reported their dice rolls in Denmark wanted to go into the civil service, which is not notorious for bribery and graft. It's the exact same study, right? There's nothing really systematically different about the people. It's that when they saw the incentives that civil service equals bribery in India, they thought, okay, yeah, the unscrupulous among us will self-select. So there's an intersection between self-selection bias and how systems operate. And the way that this is most clearly manifesting itself in the best example that I've come across is, unfortunately, in policing, particularly in the United States. Now, I grew up in Minneapolis, which unfortunately is the city where George Floyd was murdered. So this is a very important problem in my hometown. And what I'm showing you on the screen is the opening screenshot from a recruitment video for a police department in Doraville, Georgia. Doraville, Georgia is a town of 10,000 people outside of Atlanta, and what this is an image of the Punisher, who's a vigilante anti-hero comic book villain slash hero who tortures criminals. The next screen doesn't get much better. It's a tank, and it's a SWAT team, and what they do is they drive around, and they open the hatch, and they toss out smoke grenades. They get out in military fatigues, and then they attack these unseen targets, and they shoot them, and then they get back in the tank. And the entire thing is set to death metal music, right? Now, when we watch that video, I hope, almost all of us will say, okay, I'm definitely not signing up for that police department, right? This is super weird, and I do not want to be a part of this. But the thing is that there's a certain cross-section of the population that looks at that video and says, yeah, I want to be the Punisher. This will be perfect. This is my career path, right? Those are the people who apply. The people who think policing is about helping little old ladies cross the street don't apply because they look at this and they think, okay, I don't want to drive around in a literal tank in my small suburb, right? So there's a self-selection problem. Now, I know this is a little bit of an extreme example, but there's multiple examples throughout the United States, and the U.S. government actually made this worse because they used surplus military equipment from Afghanistan and Iraq, and they gave it to local police departments. So they ended up using a lot of the military equipment, and the people who wanted to play with military equipment signed up for policing. So what's the alternative? Well, the alternative is what New Zealand did. And what New Zealand did that was very clever is they thought to themselves very carefully about self-selection bias. They said, if we represent policing differently, maybe we'll get different recruits. So these are a few screenshots I'm going to show you from a video that the New Zealand police produced, the cost of a few million dollars, very, very cheap for what it ended up yielding. And what they show is a demographically diverse police force, lots more women and ethnic minorities in the video than you would expect. Of course, in the Doraville, Georgia recruitment video, everyone was a white man. And on top of this, there's various gags throughout the video. So you have a officer stopping to help a man cross the street. In the next frame, he stops and a man with a boombox plays some music and they dance together. And they're all chasing this unseen perpetrator, right? This criminal who they're going to hunt down. And in the final scene of the video, they catch him. And it turns out to be a border collie who's stolen a woman's purse. Now, the difference between the tank and the Punisher and the border collie is summed up very, very well by the final screenshot of the video. Do you care enough to be a cop? right? I mean, it's the exact polar opposite. Now, what happened? Lo and behold, when they tested the recruits that they got, they were totally different. And they were different in a few key ways. First off, there were way more of them, right? So people who didn't think of themselves as police officers to begin with started to think, I do care enough to be a cop. I could do this. So they applied. All of a sudden, the ranks have expanded of the applicants. That means that you can be more selective and pick better officers. Secondly, the number of women and ethnic minorities shot through the roof who applied for the police. And this was important because there's strained tensions between, for example, the Maori community, the ethnic indigenous community in New Zealand, and the police force, and violence decreased. So for a few million dollars of just carefully thinking about how you represent a position of power, they solved a significant chunk of their problem. They got better officers, and that's a self-fulfilling prophecy where you start to have a virtuous cycle, right? Because the officers in the force are people who are public service-oriented. When somebody else comes into the police, they teach them how to perform public service. In the Doraville Police Department, it's the exact opposite. They say, look, when we get called, suit up, get your gun ready, we're an occupying army, right? So you have aspects of this where they're knock-on effects that last for years and years and years, and all they had to do was think carefully about the recruitment. And yet, what do we do most of the time? We recruit on autopilot. We do it the same way we did in the past. We don't think about representing power any differently. Now, here comes the awkward part of my talk. It's about us. Are we to blame? So we live in democracies, right? We have democratic responsive governments that are supposed to do what we say. And they're supposed to be elected by us. And yet, consistently, we pick snakes in suits. We pick people who we know are not good. And we do this for a variety of reasons. And one of the things that happens is that we make irrational decisions when it comes to who we choose to be in power. Now, this has been proven in a variety of different studies. So one of the ones that really stuck out to me was a study that shows how early on this effect happens. There's a study where, and it's been replicated, it's very solid science, where what they did was they showed children a set of images between two people's faces. And they said, okay, imagine you are about to have an imaginary ship and you need to decide who will be the captain of your boat, right? These are kids. But all you have to go on is the face. You look at two faces and you point and you say, that's the captain, okay? What the kids didn't know was that the faces were not a random assortment. The faces were the winner of an election and the runner-up of an election. So the person who won and the person who came in second. And what they found was that overwhelmingly, in the significant majority of the time, the children picked the winner, right? For no reason other than their face. That was it. So already there's an irrationality built in. And when they did this with adults, it was even more pronounced. The effect was even more pronounced. It's been replicated in different contexts, U.S. governors, French elections, etc. We are making decisions based on who should lead us on things that are incredibly stupid. And some of them are just faces, right? Some of them are how people look. Do they look like a leader to us? Now, the problem about somebody looking like a leader to us is that the people who currently are our leaders are not representative of the population. If you look at Fortune 500 CEOs, the CEOs of the biggest 500 companies in the United States, you see there's a massive skew, right? I mean, just look at the one under white men, people who look like me. 30% of the U.S. population, 86% of the CEOs. It depends on when you count it, but very often there are more CEOs named John in the FTSE 100 in the UK than there are CEOs who are women. And you have aspects where you look at other minority groups. I mean, no black women, 6.5% of the population. Under Latinos, 18% of the population, 2% of the CEOs, and so on and so forth. So what happens is you have these problems where you first off have an irrationality that exists, and then it's compounded by social biases. So who looks like a leader is partly ingrained in our psyche, which I'll talk about in a second, and partly ingrained by how we're socialized, by who our current crop of leaders are. And this is why we have to be so careful about how we design systems of power, because we have to counteract these things. We have to acknowledge our stupid biases and fix them. Now, our biases are not just social and not just learned in our lifetimes. They are tied to evolutionary mismatches about how our brains have evolved for very different environments from the modern systems that we find ourselves in. This evolutionary mismatch hypothesis is a hallmark of evolutionary psychology, and what the proponents of it argue is that for much of human society's, you know, vast expanse, we're talking hundreds of thousands of years, When you were in a moment of crisis, there actually was a survival advantage that was tied to picking a physically large man as your leader. And this was often because you faced a threat from the outside, you needed a warrior, you needed a hunter, and therefore there was actually a tie between survivability and physically large men. This is no longer true, right? It's absolutely no longer true. Some of our best leaders in the world, who also, by the way, have willingly given up power in ways that men often don't, are women. And yet this cognitive bias still exists. We've done tests, psychologists and so on have done tests where they look at hypothetical leaders. And they prime people. They say, imagine there's a war on, or a pandemic, or a famine. Now pick the leader. And what they find is that in those instances of crisis, people systematically gravitate towards physically large men. It's incredibly stupid. It makes no sense. But the data show that it happens, right? So we can either pretend it's not there, or we can think about it carefully and how to counteract it. Now, some leaders know that this is the case. We call these people strongmen. There's no coincidence. They're physically strong men. And they like to activate this latent part of our brains that has evolved to gravitate towards people like them as a way to amplify their persuasive appeal to their public. What happens every time Vladimir Putin feels like he might be in trouble? He poses shirtless. He poses shirtless again. And he poses shirtless again. In fact, he inspires art of him posing shirtless. So when you think about these aspects, there is a reason for this. It's not irrational. Now, I do not think that Vladimir Putin is reading psychology literature and making his adjustments to his leadership style accordingly, but I do think he's tapped into this aspect of our psychology that is incredibly, incredibly stupid and yet does actually affect our decision making. Now, imagine any other context in which this would happen. Imagine that you have a dentist that's the leading dentist in Copenhagen, and you're about to get your wisdom teeth removed on the operating table, and they rip open their shirt and show their prowess. I mean, you would report them to the board immediately, right? You would get another dentist. And yet we have in politics this idea that this is like part of what it might mean to be a politician, these shows of machismo and sort of strength. And then we have another problem. I know there's a lot of problems, but there's another one. Psychopaths.
You're listening to Brian Kloss on The Wrong People at the Top. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
And then we have another problem. I know there's a lot of problems, but there's another one. Psychopaths. Now, there may be a link to Vladimir Putin. I can't clinically diagnose him, but I will say that psychopaths are a real problem when it comes to positions of power. A psychopath is someone who might not look like a psychopath. One of the things that is a characteristic of psychopathy is that they're very, very good at blending in and looking like everybody else. And they have three traits in particular which form what's called the dark triad. The dark triad is composed of narcissism, so extreme egotism, Machiavellianism, where someone is a strategic thinker where the ends justifies the means for them, especially in getting power, and psychopathy, or being a psychopath. These are not good traits to exist in common, and unfortunately they correlate very often with each other. Now, if you think about why they're not good, in addition to the fact that you wouldn't want a psychopath in charge, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second, think about what they end up doing. There's this drive for power. Remember the Abraham Vald story about the airplanes and the World War II survivorship bias. Psychopaths are obsessed with power over other people. Okay, that's seeking power. Machiavellians are very strategic thinkers who are good at getting what they want. That's getting power. And narcissists are so obsessed with their ego and how others perceive them that they actually can detect threats because they understand when they're getting unpopular with their colleagues. So that's maintaining power. It's the perfect cocktail. So you have this cocktail of psychological traits that is highly correlated with ending up in power, and unfortunately not with wielding it well. Depending on the study that you look at, it's measured different ways, there's different scales and different checklists and so on for psychopathy. The number of people who are in power who are psychopaths is somewhere between 4 times and 25 times the general public. This is not good, right? This is a very, very bad thing for us, because even though they may be ruthlessly calculating individuals who sometimes can be logical thinkers, in those moments of crisis, when things are really on the line and change is happening rapidly, that's when empathy is most important. It's when you have to care about other people, and they don't have it. In fact, psychopaths are really fascinating in how they don't have empathy. They have something that's wrong with their brains in this section of the brain called the amygdala, regulates emotions. And there's various discussions about what causes psychopathy. There's a discussion where some people think it's you're born with it, some people think it's environmental factors, and some people think it's a combination of the two. But what is clear is that when you put psychopaths in MRI scanners and you look at their brains while you show them extremely disturbing videos. So in one study I'm thinking of, they show them videos of children and animals suffering in really horrific ways. The psychopath's brains were blank. They didn't react, didn't bother them. When they scanned normal people, they lit up like a firework and they asked to get out of the MRI scanner, please. However, this is the crucial bit. There was a sort of little stroke of insight that one of the researchers had, and she said, what happens if I tell the psychopaths to imagine what it would be like to care about those people? Imagine that you have empathy. Put them back in the scanner, rescan the brains, turn on the videos. Normal. They look effectively normal. And what this means is that psychopaths can pass as normal people when they need to. However, some are not very good at this. And this is where you get a divide between the unsuccessful psychopaths and the successful psychopaths. The unsuccessful psychopaths are not disciplined. Where do they end up? Prison. They kill people, they abuse people, and they commit crimes. So there's a very high proportion of the incarcerated population for violent crimes, for example, that are psychopaths. And those are people who, when they needed to be disciplined, when they needed to pass like the rest of us, they couldn't. They couldn't turn it off. They couldn't upregulate the empathy that they needed to. The successful psychopaths, in a variety of different studies of what is called snakes in suits, they're in boardrooms and they're in politics. And they're people who understand how to turn on the empathy, to make shows of it when they need to act like normal people, and yet they don't. They don't actually feel it. And this is a huge problem. It's a huge problem because it links again to the system, what I talked about before, being on autopilot. When you talk to experts on psychopathy, as I have many, many around the world, what they always say, without fail, are these two words: psychopaths yield superficial charm. Superficial charm means, in a short period, not for years and years and years, but for a short period, they can make them very likable to you, right? They can make people like them. That's bad news for us, because the way we've designed promotion and sort of election to power is effectively the job interview, 45-minute exercise, can you make someone like you in 45 minutes? Elections, you're never going to actually meet these people, most of them, but you have to get an impression of them that is superficially charming. We've designed systems that amplify these traits. They reward them because they don't have to show effective performance. They have to show likability. So we're systematically downgrading the appeal for a person who's an introvert, who has a really hard time speaking in public and so on. And we're amplifying traits that are not necessarily tied to servant leadership and public service and good leaders, but are just tied to superficial charm. So these are not areas where we can just sort of say, let's just do what we did before, right? We have to think much more carefully about how we design systems in this realm. And when it comes to psychopaths, you know, they're still a minority. It's very unlikely that your boss is a psychopath. Maybe some of you. But it is statistically unlikely still. The problem is that they do disproportionate damage, right? So when you think about psychopaths in power, one of the arguments that sometimes is made around them, and you'll see books, there's a book called The Wisdom of Psychopaths, for example, by Kevin Dutton. And what he argues is that we have to find a place for these people. Why not just put them in high stress situations? Because one of the things that psychopaths have that the rest of us don't is they are very, very calm when an emergency is going on and when things normally would fluster the rest of us. A psychopath doesn't have their heart rate elevate, they don't get an emotional response, etc. So what Dutton argues, I think persuasively, is around the idea of, for example, a bomb defusal expert in the military. I can see the argument here a little bit. But I think he goes a little bit too far when he talks about surgeons. It's true that a surgeon is under stress, under immense pressure, and may need to be a cold, calculating individual. But I put it to you this way. You go to the doctor, you go to the surgery for your operation, And they say, don't worry, you're in good hands. We've got a psychopath today. I mean, nobody's going to go. You're going to run out of that room, right? So the problem is that when it really counts, we don't think this way. And when it really counts, if we're not willing to have somebody with a scalpel operate on one person, why could we possibly tolerate entire societies being run often by psychopaths? And this is particularly problematic in worse systems, right? So I can't speak about, I'm not a clinical psychiatrist. I can't speak about Denmark psychopaths. What I can say is that when it comes to dictators, I would bet a lot of money that very, very many of them are psychopaths. And the reason why I would bet that is because another trait that they have, which makes them destructive in power, is they discount risk. They don't think risk applies to them because they're smarter than everybody else. That's what they think anyway, right? Now, this is a problem for dictators because dictators often die in office or they get jailed or they get forced into exile. Very few dictators have a cushy retirement. And what that means is that when you think about entering power in a dictatorial system, you know, some of the people that I've spoken to, former heads of state in Thailand and Madagascar and all around the world, those people have to think, well, that happened to my predecessor, but it would never happen to me. Now, that's a psychopath trait. And so when those people do inevitably get toppled and end up getting killed or jailed or exiled, they're surprised, but they've discounted risk. Now, in our societies, discounting risk might not be necessary to enter politics. It may be, but it's not as crucial as in an authoritarian regime. But when psychopaths are in those moments of crunch time, they think, I'll roll the dice. The problem is they're rolling the dice with our lives, with our economies, CEOs making bad decisions, getting into money laundering scandals. In addition to this, you have issues where, you know, these problems are things where you can put safeguards in them. Because what I've talked about so far is issues related to all sorts of areas of power. And they're multifaceted, right? The self-selection bias, who seeks power. The Machiavellians being better at getting power. The psychopaths overrepresented in power. Power corrupting, the Ma'anan Sheilas of the world. So we've got a lot of problems. How are we going to fix it? Well, there's a lot of different ways we can tackle this problem, and I don't have unlimited time, but I am going to cover a few that I think are worth considering. One of them is exploiting the power of randomness. In fact, two of them exploit the power of randomness. And I'm going to tell you a story that's really interesting from the New York Police Department. I interviewed the former head of internal affairs at the NYPD, and he's a man who basically, his livelihood is about catching crooked cops, right? He's trying to expose people who are stealing or beating up people or using too much violence in the NYPD. And what he designed was an ingenious, ingenious tactic that I think we should use much more widely. He designed what are called integrity tests. So what he would do is he'd rent an apartment in New York City, and this would be the fake crime scene. The fake crime scene would dispatch an officer and they would say, look, we've just been tipped off. We think there's some money and some drugs in this place. There's nobody there. We need you to go and survey the scene and wait for backup to arrive. But nobody's been there yet. Now, when the officer would arrive, there would be, let's say, $20,000 on the table in cash. There'd also be a whole bunch of drugs with a high street value. What the officer didn't know is that the whole building was wired up with cameras and microphones. And what they were doing is they were trying to see, what does this officer do? Do they take the money? Do they just report it as 20,000 and the exact number of bags of drugs on the table and so on? Some of the time, the officers said, I found $14,000. And they took 6,000 home with them. Now, when that happened, these officers were arrested or fired. But here's the crucial bit. They only did about 500 integrity tests through this entire year that they started the pilot. They did a survey of officers in the NYPD, and they said, were you the subject of an integrity test this year? Did you go to a fake crime scene? 6,000 officers said yes. What that means is that 5,500, 12 times as many as the real number, thought they were at set-up crime scenes when they were at real ones. And everybody else in the NYPD thought they could be at a fake crime scene anytime they responded to a call. So with just 500 sting operations against these crooked cops, the entire force became better. Because all of them feared that it was a setup. It was a possibility, right? You didn't need to make every cop go through the test. You just need to make it so that every so often one would. And every so often they catch word of the cop being fired because they stole money. The rates of abuse plummeted. They even did some of these integrity tests, which imagine this is your job. You would provoke an officer to try to hit you. So you would be posing as a sort of civilian, and you'd be insulting them, and you'd be trying to get them to hit you. And if they did, they'd be fired, right? Now, these integrity tests, again, very often the police officers would sometimes hit real civilians. But of course, in these issues, that rate declined as well because they feared being exposed. The second area where the power of randomness is very helpful is with defeating the self-selection problem. This is an image of what's called the Clericterion, which is from ancient Athens. And it was effectively a way of developing a citizen assembly that was sort of like jury duty. They had various rows in the Clericterion. You'd put in your little trinket that was for you. And if they drew your row, you had to be someone who was governing society for that period of time. Random selection. Now, I don't think, this is called, by the way, in political science, we call this sortition. I don't think sortition is a good idea to replace politicians. And the reason I don't think it's a good idea to replace them is because there are actually things that a lifetime of being a politician does teach you. And some of those things are very technical, right? So if you have a nuclear test ban treaty or you're dealing with a geopolitical crisis, it's actually good that some of the people who are making decisions know some of the background. However, I do think we should do random selection for oversight. And what I mean by this is that you randomly take the same number of people who are in your parliament, your Congress, as it were, and you give them the exact same questions. You give them exactly the same access to experts. And you say, what would you decide? Now, what you've taken out is you've taken out the money, you've taken out the power for its own sake, you've taken out the self-selection bias, you've taken out the lobbying, and you've taken out the re-election. Many of the things that warp our decisions. Now, even if these people couldn't actually choose for us, they couldn't change the taxes, they couldn't decide whether to send weapons to Ukraine or whatever it was of the day, what would be really fascinating is, imagine you're a journalist and you're interviewing a politician on one of the Sunday news programs. And you say, you know, it's really interesting that you've decided to award this contract to this group. Because when we asked the randomly assorted selection of citizens, they didn't do anything like that. They had a totally different answer. And now it's provided some oversight, a check, saying, look, you know, ordinary people answer this question very easily. They compromise. They come up with a solution. It's pragmatic. Why can't you? And that aspect would put pressure on the politicians, right? So between the random selection for oversight and this aspect, I think we can get a lot done in positions of power. And by the way, when it comes to integrity tests, I know this is a slightly zany idea, but I believe it would work. I think we should do sting operations for politicians. If it's good enough for cops, why isn't it good enough for politics? Try to get the best lobbyists. Try to get a crooked deal through. Have a journalist organize a fake company. In the UK where I live, there was a huge amount of waste of money around the pandemic because conservative members of the government were giving contracts to their friends to procure masks and other PPE when they had no track record of providing this stuff. Imagine just one time the Times of London had set up a fake company, had greased the wheels with a lobbyist, got a politician to agree to give the contract. Every future procurement would be scary because the possibility that this was a setup would exist. You wouldn't have to do it repeatedly, you'd have to do it once. And I think these areas, this healthy dose of fear, is something we need to instill in people who are at the very top of society. I think the same could be true for CEOs, by the way. The other thing that I want to talk about is how we need to seek out leaders rather than waiting for them. Many of you will know people who have a track record of leadership. Maybe it's unsung heroes of your society. Maybe it's people who have worked on a small stage, not a big one, but they've had a track record of success. And they don't want to be politicians. They don't want to be CEOs. And I can understand that, right? I mean, it's a very, very awful and ruthless game to be at the top levels of power. But we need them. We need these people. So the question is, how do we get them? Well, what's really bizarre, I used to work in politics in the U.S. I worked in a campaign for governor of my home state. I was the deputy campaign manager for that campaign. And what's really striking about politics is they invest a tiny proportion of money in candidate recruitment. And the reason they do this is very understandable. There's a long line of people already there. Why do you need to spend money to recruit when you've got a line of 10 people who want to be in the job? Now, those 10 people are power hungry, and they're probably not the best people for the job. And when you think about why we have elections where you vote for people where you're like, I don't want either of them, that's part of this candidate recruitment problem. So what you need to do is you need to invest in recruiting people with a track record of leadership who do not think of themselves as politicians. And on top of this, you need to ask a simple question of people who want to be in power. The question I got asked by a few people who do interviews for candidates or who work in, you know, various aspects of high-level business, what question would you ask someone who wants to be powerful? And I have a very simple answer. What do you want the power for? And what would cause you to step down after you'd achieved it? And the reason that question is so effective is because people who actually seek power, the power hungry among us, do not see power as a means to an end. They see power as a goal. So they get completely flustered by this question. They don't know what to say. They hang on for as long as they can, right? I mean, very, very rarely do you have politicians who just say, well, I did my 4 years, that was a good time, we got what we wanted done, I'm out, right? They think about it as, how long can I stay? How long can I cling to this? I'll go kicking and screaming when the scandal finally hits. So the people who can answer that question without missing a beat, those are the people you want in charge. The people who don't want power are also the people you want in charge. They're the invisible airplanes of our society. They're the people who understand that power should be a burden. It should not be a calling. It should be difficult. It should hurt you when you make decisions, because decisions at the top levels of leadership are difficult. They cause people pain. If you're a prime minister or president of a country, you are hurting people. Now, you may be making the best decision, but you're still going to cause problems for a lot of people in your society. And if you have a properly functioning amygdala, that should keep you up at night. So when you think about it, power is not something that's supposed to be a reward. It's supposed to be a price, but it's the price that you pay for a good society. And we need people who feel like, I will take on that price for some time. I will do it because I care about my fellow citizens. I will do it because I think I can make the world just a little bit better. And I can't say it much better than the quote from one of my favorite writers, Douglas Adams, who says, it is a well-known fact that those people who most want to rule people are those least suited to do it. Anyone who is capable of getting themselves made president should on no account be allowed to do the job. And this is true. When you think about what we actually are selecting for, we're selecting for people who want power. We're also doing things like, what skill set do you have? Can you evade a tough question? The people who evade tough questions survive. The people who answer questions honestly and show their flaws get destroyed, right? So we're selecting over and over and over for things that are not tied to leadership, but are tied to being slippery, tied to being self-serving, tied to being narcissistic, and tied to being powerful for the sake of power. And I think this is the area of our modern societies that we have to focus more attention on is the systems. When you open the newspaper, you endlessly get disappointed, right? There's terrible news often in the news. And what you see are often a series of scandals, powerful people behaving badly. But what we do as a society that's not a smart response to this is we condemn the individual and move on. Oh, that person was corrupt. Let's replace them. Oh, that person was corrupt and abused power. Let's replace them. We think about the tip of the iceberg. We think about the planes in front of us. We think about the people who are powerful now who we can see. And the problem with that approach is that we're just going to keep on replicating this world, right? I mean, I have literally never met, and maybe there'll be somebody amongst you who will come up to me after the talk and be the first person, because we are in Denmark after all. But I've never met someone who said to me, what's the point of your work? We get it right. I'm happy with the people on top. I'm happy with the people who are in charge. I think the system is working just fine. So even in one of the most prosperous societies in the world, like in Denmark, this is a place we can obviously do better. And I think there's a widespread sort of view that the people in charge of us are not fit for leadership. So the question is, what do we do? Condemn the individual or condemn the system? And it doesn't mean you need to say the system is all bad. It means that you need to think creatively about engineering a system, right? What we basically do instead is we inherit systems. We inherit them and we think that's how it's done. That's the way power works. You have this structure, we've done it for 50 years, and to which I say, yeah, and for 50 years you've been unhappy with the leaders. So you have to be creative about designing and engineering outcomes that are going to attract and promote the best among us. So what I'll close and leave you with is the idea, the optimistic idea, that we can do better. I'm not naive. I know this is going to be an incredibly uphill battle. Very powerful, very rich people do not want the system to change. They do not want to be ousted from power, right? They want the status quo. So it's going to be an uphill battle. And we will always have problems of self-selection. It's part of the nature of power. We will always have problems with power corrupting. It's part of the nature of power. If the ancient Greeks dealt with it, we're going to deal with some of these echoes too. But do we really think that we couldn't do better? I think that we could. And I think what I would suggest to you is, if you can, try to do a small act of leadership in your community. The ripple effects of that are really profound. I ended up interested in politics as a political scientist because my mom ran for school board when I was 8 years old. She was unhappy with the direction of the school system, and she said, I'm not going to make any money, there's no glory in this, but I can volunteer my time effectively, and I can try to make it a little bit better. And not only did that have ripple effects for the next generation of students who went to a better school system, it had ripple effects for me because I found the sort of inspiring aspect of someone who genuinely cared working in politics. And these small aspects of change really do add up, because the pipeline of current leaders at the local level become the pipeline of leaders at the national level. I'm not an idealist who thinks we're going to solve it all. I do think we can get 30 or 40% of the problem solved. And I think that should be the task for the 21st century, so that this is the first generation where, when I ask those questions that I started with, everybody in the room raises their hand.
You were just listening to Brian Kloss on The Wrong People at the Top. Brian Kloss is professor of global politics at the University College London. He's the author of Corruptible. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Ralph Nader, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, and Medea Benjamin. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Brian Kloss on The Wrong People at the Top, and for his book, Corruptible, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Science and Cocktails Foundation in Copenhagen and to Martin Folker. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Choir, 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 singing David Bowie's Heroes.